I'm extremely honored to be joined by Steve Watson of Infowars.net and PrisonPlanet.com from London, England, and Daniel Obuchaki, also joining us from England. Now, let me just set the table here. On the morning of 7-7-2005, three bombs blew up, destroying three different train passenger carriages, killing quite a few people, tragically. Over an hour later, a bus that had been specifically singled out and redirected, and these reports had already come out by other witnesses, exploded, causing quite a few deaths and injuries. And then it came out that the former head of Scotland Yard's public relations, Peter Powers, had been hired to run a drill of the exact same trains, exact same times, being bombed the exact same day. And we've had the actuary mathematics done on that. It's in the tertigillions. That's 43 zeros, my friends, behind it. That's many, many more times, billions of times more than all the grains of sand in all the world. On 9/11, they're doing a drill of flying hijacked jets in the World Trade Center and Pentagon at the exact same time yet again as well. It's always the same MO. They do this in case other compartments of the government discover it. The other operatives can just say, hey, we're taking part in a drill. It also bootlegs the funding. It also creates chatter that confuses Echelon, Infopol 9, the NSA, MI6, the different listening stations, so if they pick up on it, they can say, oh, that's just the drill, too. And there are hundreds of points concerning the London bombing. First, they said that it was simultaneous, and they said, no, it wasn't simultaneous. It turned out they were correct. It was simultaneous bombings on all three of the trains. Something went wrong. We had surmised from all the evidence. Something hadn't detonated on the bus. People reported there was not an Asian man down there. People had reported that suddenly there was just an explosion. Folks had reported that the bus had been singled out and diverted. I talked to bus drivers who'd heard about it. I talked to technicians who worked in that bus terminal about strange things and strange technicians working on that bus. And so we, from the evidence we had, something hadn't gone off simultaneously in the bus, so they redirected it. While they were redirecting it to make sure it went off, from all the evidence we have, MI6, MI5, or some private agency that was carrying this out, clearly in collusion with the government, needed time to cover up what was happening with the bus because something had gone wrong. So for an hour and several minutes, they were announcing a power surge had caused some type of explosions. Now, you got three blown-up trains, dead people everywhere. They're coming out, bleeding, dying. They're telling everyone bombs went off. And the police are saying, no, 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 it's a power surge. While, meanwhile, black sedans, blue sedans, motorcycles are directing this particular bus, the Hackney bus, to Tavistock Park, Tavistock Square. On board that bus is Daniel Obuchaki. And Daniel is there, and he's now going to tell you what he witnessed. And this is a eyewitness. Now, other eyewitnesses interviewed by police, and again, most police aren't involved in this. That's why we have Scotland Yard going. We don't think these guys knew they had bombs. We don't think that they were suicide bombers. We think someone gave them these packages. But then you got the problem of one of the bombers' passports, ID cards being found at two different bombings, and somebody messed up in the planting. You've got Benjamin Netanyahu being admitted to Associated Press at least 30 minutes before getting a call and being told, don't get on the trains, stay in your hotel room. This is all on record. You've got Giuliani there when this happens. All very suspicious, folks. Same people, same players. This is so disgusting. And so we have Daniel there on the bus, and he's going to tell you what he witnessed. This is huge. I cannot hype this enough. I know Steve's working on a part two with this, so I want to bring up Daniel. Daniel, thank you for coming on.
That's okay. How are you doing?
Good, sir. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then give us a nutshell, give us a thumbnail sketch of what happened on that bus that morning, what you witnessed, and then any more details that you haven't already given us for the Infowars.net story. And then I first want to say thank you for your courage, sir. Tell us first about yourself and how you got the courage to go public.
Okay, I'm just a regular guy. I've born, bred, work in London, and that day I was on my way to work in Old Street, and there was some kind of disruption going on. We were told it was a power surge, and we were evacuated, and that's how I became to be on the bus. And then after that, the bus left Houston full of passengers who were also evacuated, and the bus seemed to be going nowhere. So I looked out of the, because I was standing on the lower deck, because I wasn't sure whether I was on the correct bus. And then I peered ahead and I saw these two cars, which were a Mercedes and a BMW, blue and black, which seemed to be in front of the bus holding it up. And it was diverted about 4 or 5 minutes later down towards Tavistock Square. And I think the results are quite evident for everyone else to see what took place in Tavistock Square.
Please continue with once you got to the square, what you saw.
Oh, well, after the explosion, you can understand, I was on the floor, so it took about 5 seconds till the noise had actually quietened down, and then I just got up, and then I ran and escaped and ran straight down the street. After a few paces down the street, I saw a man holding a camera, it looks like a camcorder, who was walking towards me, filming the bus itself. I was confused by this, and I stopped and skidded to a halt and looked left, right, and what was going on. Then I looked behind me, and I saw the bus, the upper deck of which had been completely destroyed by the bomb explosion. And then I think at that point, My mind must have just changed into some kind of, I was really not frightened, but I was aware that something amiss was going on, and I was just looking at the people moving into the actual space on the square. There were guys who were hanging around. There was a row of policemen who were just standing there in yellow fluorescent suits. Jackets, they weren't doing anything, they were just watching. There was this guy filming, and I'm saying, what is going on here? It was just not, it didn't feel right. So I actually went and helped some woman who had been walking beside the bus. She was covered in blood, and then I helped her to get some kind of help at a hotel which was further down the square. And I passed this gentleman who seemed to have acquired some kind of injuries, but I couldn't understand for the life of me how this was possible, because he was 40, 50 meters away from the bus itself. So he was making a lot of noise and trying to get people's attention, but I just saw his actual injuries as fake.
In fact, you write in your description that within 60 seconds, he had a bandage on his head and there weren't even paramedics around him.
Exactly. They hadn't even shown up yet.
Can you say that in your own words, though? I mean, describe it in detail for us.
Well, he had a bandage around his head, and he had his trouser leg had been split neatly along the seam, and he was rolling on the pavement. This was 50 meters away from the bus itself. The bus bomb itself blew backwards, so one lady who was at the back where I was standing in the center of the bus, or by the window, she actually died, and someone walking behind the bus also died. So the bus blew backwards, the bomb blew backwards. So this guy, it was just a complete fake injury, and he was just some guy who was, I don't know what his role was specifically. There were a lot of people observing, I noted. Some people were running forward, the medical staff and the medical professionals were, you could tell who they were because they were trying to see what they could do for people. Some people were just, they weren't going to make it. Some people, they were trying to do something for them. But then there were these other people who were just watching, taking note, organizing people, moving, saying,
how many seconds, how long did it take you to get out of the bus? And then how long did it take you, because you say 60 seconds, to then notice that this guy's way up the street with a bandage on his head rolling around?
I left the bus within 12 seconds. I got down the street in another 10 seconds. So within 25 seconds, I had witnessed the cameraman, and about 15 seconds after that, I actually noted this chap. So it was within 45 seconds, he was actually with some kind of headband and lying on the street. And I don't know how he got there, because if it was a bus blast, he must have been flung about 40 to 50 feet. And that is not really feasible with the injuries which he was displaying.
And it was the wrong direction from the way the blast
went. Precisely.
How many operative types or police did you see when you got off the bus around you already staring at it?
Okay, there were about four guys in blue bottoms and who had rucksacks. They were kind of foot soldier types. There were about two or three people who were just standing in the doorway, just watching everything. And there was another guy who was coordinating everything, coordinating. He was in plain clothes and coordinating police when they finally came forward to actually do something.
Just all there waiting. Oh, here comes the bus. Boom. Ha. Unbelievable, sir. Please stay with us. We've got Steve Watson waiting in the wings with other key comments and questions. Your courage is amazing. Daniel Obachek, he is our guest, born and bred Londoner. Talking during the break, it was just unbelievably powerful. I remember making Terror Storm and saying to Rob, my editor here in the office, I go, that photo looks fake. Bandages all over his face, thinly placed, no blood except on his chest, and it looked like it was put on out of a ketchup dispenser, little squirters that you use, just kind of dribble down the front. And so many times my instincts are right. Well, it turns out that's the individual that within 60 seconds was flopping around and prancing around in front of cameras and all the waiting police. And notice, though, they didn't, all over every major newspaper in the world, all over every major television network in the world, every news program in the world, no one interviewed him, no one said, where is he now, no one said his name, everybody else they show bloody or bleeding, a day later they'd say, here's their name, not him, and now the photo's being jerked everywhere. Please relay and repeat the words you told me during the break, Daniel. Please, in your own words, lay this out.
This guy, he was the one that got my kind of curiosity going, because I walked past there with this, escorting this woman who was hurt, and then I saw him. He had this bandage around his head, his leg seemed to, his trouser leg was torn, and this was within 45, less than 60 seconds after the explosion, a time before any medical staff had come forward. And the thing about him was, he just seemed so fake. So I thought this man must have had prior knowledge, prior intelligence. And he was positioned here. For what reason, I don't know. Then I conducted a search of my own online, because a few days after the 7th of July, his picture, his image was everywhere. And about a month ago, I looked, and it had been totally pulled. I mean, it wasn't on any of the BBC websites. It wasn't on any of the international news sites. You just couldn't find this guy. I actually spent about 2 days searching, and then I got two images of him, and that's what you see on World Wide Web, theforcebomb.com, which is my site, where the truth and the facts of what happened in Tavistock Square that day are.
Now, again, your story meshes with all the other witnesses, all the other evidence we have, but I want to be clear before we bring Steve Watson up in the next segment, who broke this with you, and I really am thankful for his great journalistic skills and your courage. Going back, specifics, slow down, take your time. When you see the blue and black Mercedes and the motorcycle cop and the discussion with the bus driver and it's redirected, let's go back to when they first directed you in the bus to Tavistock Square.
Okay, yeah. Well, what do you want to know? The bus was...
Just slow down and describe everything to me. Just slow down and tell me how they pulled up, what they did, what they, you know, what their body motions were like, just everything, what they looked like.
Okay, it left Euston Bus Station and proceeded down Euston Road. It was supposed to go straight from Euston to King's Cross, but these two cars were blocking its path. And then after a short time, a police motorcyclist whizzed up on his bike and had a word with one of the drivers. And
white men, black men, Asian men, what do they look like?
No, the police, the drivers were of European appearance. The motorcyclist had a helmet, so but he had a brief word with one of the drivers. And I thought, okay, thank God for that. This guy will tell the driver to go and then we can get to where we need to be going. And but instead of the police motorcyclist getting the cars to leave, they told him to leave, and he just turned around and sped off. And then
did you see them flash anything?
They didn't flash anything. He waved something. It could have been some kind of card or pass or something. But as soon as the police
motorcycle, who waved? The driver of the blue Mercedes or the black?
The driver of the BMW.
And what color? Waved. What color? The BMW was blue, correct?
Blue, yes. The driver of the BMW waved the motorcyclist away with some form of identification.
Ah.
I only assume he had some form of identification.
But you saw him, something in the hand, waved it.
Yeah, that was it.
Absolutely key. Stay there. Your debriefing will continue on the other side. Steve Watson will join in. This is absolutely vital, and we're trying to keep this man safe right now by him getting his entire story out in more detail. I'm Alex Jones, battling the New World Order at point blank range.
We're on the march. The Empire's on the run. Alex Jones and the GCN Radio Network.
I know it was 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. I know that it's not big and spectacular like 9/11, but a lot of people died, and it was used when the British nation was refusing to go along with the war in Iraq, when Tony Blair had barely hung on to his position, when he had lost almost the entire majority that the Labour Party had in Parliament. And it came right when they were having their big G8 summit in Glen Eagles. And it was used as a grandstanding platform to say, see, the terrorists are hitting us. We've got to get tough. And every indices, every piece of evidence, even Scotland Yard and other police forces who had real detectives out were going, these guys weren't suicide bombers. That's buried in the newspaper. These guys, we think somebody planted this stuff on them, or they didn't know. They don't fit the M.O. There was a bomb under one of the trains, not in it. Eyewitnesses said that. You add all these, there's hundreds of points. We put them in the film Terror Storm that I hope you'll get from Infowars.com. That's why it's so important. We spend about 30 minutes of the two-hour film, or a little bit more than 30 minutes, in London documenting this. And we even show shots of newsstands. We were there 2 weeks after the attacks. And we show newsstands where there's literally like 15, 20 newspapers and magazines, and it's all pictures of the bombing, and half of them are this guy with the thin one layer of bandage. Understand, folks, I've worked for a large animal vet. My dad's an oral surgeon. I've been in hospitals. I've worked around it. I've worked in the medical field when I was in college as a dental assistant. Even if you haven't, you know common sense. You don't take thin gauze bandage, one layer. And if you even put that on a scuff on your knee that really doesn't bleed but kind of just seeps, you know, when you're playing touch football and you fall down on your knee and it just kind of seeps. I mean, even if it was just seeping, just a microscopic graze, it would stick to his face. No, it appears to be a cap woven heavily on the top and then just thin one straps around his face, like it was some type of already woven helmet he just put on his head. 45 to 60 seconds after the blast, He's flopping around way towards the front, 50 yards north of it. There's other people videotaping, spook types walking around, and then no interviews with him. We never learn his name. He's just, you remember the guy with the bandage. And those eyes have it all, ferret-like, scanning, calculating. And I just remember going, man, that is, something's going on. That doesn't look right. And then he has like a potato, a ketchup bottle, you know, that you spray onto your potatoes, you spray onto your french fries, like a dribble on his shirt. And you take movies like The Quiet American by Graham Greene, which is based on real events. They just changed the names. That's when the Times of London reporter, who's based there in southern Vietnam, he's been recruited by the CIA guy. He doesn't know he's CIA. And the CIA guy is actually running terror attacks to blame it on the North to escalate the war. This is before the war really kicks off in the late 1950s, and it's based on true stories that really happened. And then all of a sudden he didn't know the guy's CIA, and suddenly these bombings blow up in the square and kill all these women and children, and then he's running around, the CIA guy, giving orders in Vietnamese, and the Times of London writer just goes and just leans back and realizes, well, literally the man you're listening to right now saw something just like you see in that movie. Just like what you see in that fictionalized account of real events in Vietnam. Okay? That's why this is so important. Daniel, I want to go to Steve Watson and bring him up for any questions. He's been holding for 20 minutes. But I'd like you to then talk about what happened in a nutshell after all of this. What started happening from that point on, please, sir?
I will do. Okay, yeah. Well, it took the police investigating anti-terrorist branch of Scotland Yard 7 months to question me. I actually called them, contacted the emergency information hotline the following day, but they didn't get back to me until the end of January in 2006. And I just felt it was as though they were trying to whitewash me to make out that I was not even there to actually completely this make it look as though I was not even on board the bus.
But it is on record that you were there, and there's an upcoming book concerning it.
Yeah, there is. That's what the fourth bomb, the book, is about, and what I went through. I had some surveillance, I don't know whether they were MI5, anti-terrorist branch, or what government organization, but I had a lot of probing. I even gave an interview with a journalist called Duffy. He was working for the Sunday Mirror, and he showed me a picture. This was a week after the actual 7/7. He showed me a picture of Hasib Hussein, and then he asked me, have you seen this person? And I said no. And about a day or two after that, then it was Hasib Hussein was named as the bus bomber in the British press.
And let's be clear, none of the people on the bus said they saw any Asian men.
No, they didn't. And I was downstairs, I saw no Asian guy at all. So,
well, in your own words, describe it. Did you see any, and the other witnesses said they didn't, but did you see any Asian men?
None whatsoever. None on board the bus, none carrying a rucksack at Euston or on the bus or at Tavistock Square.
Off the charts, absolutely off the charts.
Yeah.
Now you describe this harassment as overt surveillance, I guess, to intimidate you. Walk us through that, some of the stuff they did.
It just started by following me when I came out of my office on lunch breaks. They were waiting on the corner. There's a place called the Honorable Artillery Barracks. And that's 10 minutes from where I worked, and that is where they kept all the dead bodies from the 7/7 attacks. So the police outside there, every time I used to walk past, they used to have something to say, call my name or something like that. I think it was just a campaign trying to put psychological stress and pressure upon me, because obviously if it came down to me testifying, they want me to be deemed unfit to testify or something like that. And but I think they just didn't want a public inquiry anyway. So they got their own way, and there was no public inquiry.
Any other types of harassment? And then let's talk about how you finally got your meeting with the police and what they did.
Yeah, well, I was chased once in Aldgate. A guy just came after me. I had arranged to meet someone from the office, and then I got there. This guy came after me, so I actually ran into this building, and then he ran in there and followed me, and I actually hid in some offices. And
what did he look like? I mean, I'm not saying I'm a tough guy, but if somebody wants to run up on me, I'm going to deck them. Yeah. I guess it's smarter to run. But yeah. I mean, explain to me what happened. I mean, describe it in detail. What did he look like? I mean, did he like growl and start running at you? I mean, what happened?
He was actually there waiting for me. That's the thing which threw me initially. He was there waiting for me, and as soon as I went past him, he just set off across the road and came after me. So I didn't run because I was scared of him, because I'm not scared of any of these people.
Obviously, you're on air.
I know I'm not scared. If they want to do what they want to do, go ahead and do it. The truth is going to be out there regardless. So I just tried to escape from him by ducking into some building, and then he.
You know, I just thought here. And I'm stupid. My instinct was I would have gotten a fight, but you're smart because by then you knew it was police, and actually they would have then got you claiming you just assaulted an officer, and you know the 50 cameras on you in the surveilled city of 4.5 million would have all malfunctioned, and then they would have claimed you assaulted an officer.
Yeah, precisely. That's what they were trying to do all along, because they asked my flatmate whether I had any criminal convictions. They were already delving into my background and my past, trying to find out whether I had any kind of dodgy or criminal past or tendencies or convictions. And I think they were trying to use that as a kind of weapon with which they
It's a lever. That's what spooks and operatives and informants do. We deal with that here locally. Please continue. Well, you know what? I want to bring Steve Watson up. You're just telling so much more now. Steve, thanks for holding. Any other key points you want to bring up here with Daniel?
Well, I was just going to say, why do you think it is that the police didn't ask you to come in and give a statement straight away? But, you know, it was later revealed that they relied on the testimony of people who were at the scene, but, you know, they were either injured or even unconscious in some cases. And also, could you talk about some of the phone calls that you got from, you said you got some phone calls from different police departments across the country.
And you posted those up on your website as well. Yeah, talk about that.
They were from the West Yorkshire Police Constabulary. They were the police constabulary investigating the four alleged bombers. And one of them decided to call me one evening and suggest something which I couldn't make out. I said, hey, you've got the wrong number, guy. But he continued and called the following day, and I recorded it and posted it on the web. It just says that I had a vehicle which was involved with transporting something or other to do with the investigation into the 7/7 bombing. And I tell you what,
I forgot to do this. John, will you go to his website Daniel, give my producer at the network your website again. We've got a link to it on InfoWars.
World Wide Web, the fourth bomb. It's the four, number four, TH, bomb.com.
Yeah, go to the fourthbomb.com, and I know I've listened to that a few days ago. Where specifically is that clip so we can grab that right now and play it?
Yeah, it's if you go to one of the four boxes, I think it's the third box.
You also got audio on the web and video from the police interrogating you. Let's tell that story. Finally, 6 months later, after demanding it, you get their meeting with them. Tell us about that.
It wasn't as much as I had hoped it would. They just took my details, but what they did was he rushed through it. It took 4 hours, but he rushed through it. It wasn't really as if they were depending on my information and eyewitness account as a vital part of their inquiry, because of course they had already completed their inquiries or whatever they wanted to say were their inquiries months ago. So what they did was they waited till they'd worked out their story and then kept me running and then brought me in and just said, hey, okay, what's your story? Just so that they could do their paperwork. But that's all it was, just paperwork.
Tell folks about the diagram.
The diagram. Are you talking about which one? Because there's been quite a few. Oh, yeah, the bus diagram, which they asked me to sign. The bus diagram, which they asked me to mark out where the people were sitting on the bus and where the people were standing and what happened on the bus. The diagram was the complete wrong layout for the bus. And I said to the anti-terrorist branch detective who was taking my statement, this is completely incorrect. So by me signing this, that's just going to render everything which I've told you inadmissible. So I think it was just a ploy. They didn't really want my information, as you would understand.
Amazing. Steve, there's a lot of other facets to this. Any other questions you've got for the guests we have?
Yeah, and I would also point out that, you know, Daniel had a shirt, which I believe he still has, with, you know, victims' blood on it, which should have been taken for forensic testing, but they weren't even interested in that either. It's as if they'd worked out previously, you know, a line to take on this, and they weren't deviating from the line, even though you've got, you know, a first-hand witness here saying this is incorrect. You've got a layout of the bus which is incorrect. I mean, if this doesn't tell us that we need an independent inquiry on this, then what else does?
Daniel Obuchaki.
Okay.
Knowing what you know now, knowing all the evidence concerning government involvement or black ops involvement, intelligence involvement in past attacks and in the 7/7 attack, seeing your bus directed by these shadowy government characters, seeing people on the ground seconds after it happened, the fake bandages, what do you think was really going on there? Who do you think was behind the bombings?
Well, I know who wasn't behind the bomb of the bus, but I couldn't really hazard a guess. It was obviously someone with a lot of power higher up. So, I mean, I've got to live out here, so it's quite obvious who did it, but unless I can actually provide evidence, that's what the website is about, putting the evidence out there so people can decide for themselves.
But who didn't do it? Because you didn't see an Asian, no one else on record said they did.
Yeah, Hafiz Hussain didn't do it. Hafiz Hussain didn't blow up the bus, but hey, who did? So that's what we've got to find out, and that's what we're all working towards. And the truth will out. That's one thing I know. It's going to out. Everything you're doing, everything like-minded individuals are doing, will feed to that.
Absolutely. This is just off the charts powerful. And again, it fits with the other witness testimonies, all the other information we have. How do you think individuals who did carry this out can live with themselves just killing innocent Britoners on a bus?
I don't think they really care. They have a role and they have an objective, and their goal is doing that. If it kills people, they say, hey, that's just how it goes. We're saving you from the evil terrorists and all the crazy people in the world who are out to destroy you. So they probably see their role as helping people, even though they're just killing people.
Yeah, we got to kill a few so they'll accept security to keep them safe.
Exactly.
Totally sick. Steve Watson?
Yeah, and I mean, if we do delve into a bit of the evidence, we've got, you know, numerous advance warnings from other intelligence agencies, from French, Spanish, the Saudis, who said, you know, gave an exact time frame for this, and Scotland Yard themselves, who, you know, told the Israeli embassy on the very morning, minutes before, that it was gonna go off, and Benjamin Netanyahu, who was in a hotel on Tavistock Square, which is a point that, you know, is often missed. He was told to stay in the hotel, which, you know, that kind of proves that they had precise location information as well. So we need to, you know, keep working towards outing the truth on this.
Well, we need to put this guy's face up everywhere, and we've got technologies to scan his face, do a composite by reducing to the lines beneath the bandages. I actually know some police sketch artists who can, we can use computer mapping to get this guy's face. This is the type of stuff we'll put a 6 feet under, but what the hell? We got to stop the murderers.
Big John. Big John. Every morning at the mine, you could see him arrive. He stood 6 foot six and weighed 245, kind of broad at the shoulder, narrow at the hip. And everybody knew you didn't give no lip to Big John. Big John. Big John, Big Bad John,
Big John.
Nobody seemed to know where John called home. He just drifted into town and stayed all alone. Didn't say much, kind of quiet and shy, but if you spoke at all, you just said hi to Big John. Somebody said he came from New Orleans, where he got in a fight over a Cajun queen, and a crashing blow from a huge right hand sent a Louisiana fella to the promised land. Big John.
Big, Big John. John. Big John. Big Bad John.
Big John.
Welcome back. I tell you, the courage of our guest, Daniel Obuchicky, the courage of Steve Watson. They're over there in London in one of the biggest police states in the world. I mean, you try to videotape on the street, they come over and tell you to shut it off. They don't allow protesting now. There's secret police everywhere. It is certainly like something out of V for Vendetta. But the good news is more and more is coming out. You know, 80-something percent know they killed Diana now. 80-plus percent know they killed Dr. David Kelly. And everybody knows they're a bunch of criminals. And you're coming down. Your New World Order is going to fail. And your big fat German commander, Saxe Coburg Gotha, just your criminality will be exposed. And that's just the way it is. Daniel and Steve Watson, we've got you for a few minutes here and then 5 minutes the next. I'm going to let you go. Any other points that need to be made, please make them now. And my final question, why did you go public? When did you go public? Daniel, give us that timeline.
I had to go public. It was the only thing I could do. They were constantly harassing me, and even when I was trying to work and get jobs, they were getting in there and holding me, preventing me from gaining employment, so I had to fight back somehow. And the only way to get back is by making sure what it is they didn't want to be out there was out there. So that's what the book, the forthcoming book, theforcebomb.com, and a website is all about. It's actually something which is helping me as well, helping me get through it.
Now, who's publishing this? Because I saw a little note in your narrative that you exclusively gave us, sections of the book, but you mentioned that the publisher's like, well, let's not get into the guy with the bandages. That's not too important. What do you mean that's not too important? I hope that ends up in the book.
Well, he is referred to in the book, but it doesn't actually enhance the story that much. There is another guy who was in the square that day, an agent, who I'm going to put something on one of the internet sites like Google TV or something like that, which shows you he's actually directing the police and everything. So that's going to...
Wait, there's video of this? Tell us who he is.
I can't at the moment. It will be with you soon. As soon as it's ready, I'll just forward you the link.
What, did you find it off a local TV clip or something? I mean, and you said that's the guy that was directing, or I mean...
Well, it's going to be on those TV websites where you can download media. I'm going to stick it on one of those. So that
and I'm just trying to find out where you got the video.
It was actually televised on the British television.
I understand. So that's what I just guessed, is that later you saw the news and said, hey, that's the guy. You've got a clip of it. Buddy, if you're pulling pictures of the other one, you better get that up now and not wait till the book comes out. I'm telling you, Daniel,
I'm not stupid. I'm not waiting.
You're not stupid. You know how dangerous this is.
Yeah, it's because they just screened it on TV because they thought no one would recognize him. But because I was there, I just jumped and nearly hit the ceiling when I saw that.
and then you were able to record it. Oh, this is again.
Yeah.
Again, they're arrogant. Stay there. Final segment, we'll play some clips when we get back of these strange phone calls and things. I'm Alex Jones. Stay with me.
Big Brother, mainstream media, government cover-ups. You want answers? Well, so does he. He's Alex Jones on the GCN Radio Network. And now, live from Austin, Texas, Alex Jones.
Engaging the global crime syndicate at point-blank range, going in, through, and beyond, fearlessly defending the Constitutional Republic, defending the UK, defending all sovereign nations against globalist takeover. I'm Alex Jones, your host, and Daniel Obuchaki is our guest, along with our writer and editor of Infowars.net and contributor to PrisonPlanet.com, Steve Watson. We have one clip. There's video clips, a lot more. You got to visit the Fourth Bomb website. We'll give you before our guest leaves here in just a few minutes. But this clip we're about to play, again, briefly describe this phone call you got. You got one from him the next day. You were smart enough to record it. Tell us what we're about to hear.
Yeah, it's a call from West Yorkshire Police, the police who were investigating the four bombers. And it was, I got this August, which was about a month or so after the 7th of July bombings.
And again, they were there videotaping all the victims so they'd know who to intimidate and control for whoever wasn't unconscious. Here's the clip right here.
I'm calling from South Yorkshire Police.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to get some correspondence out to yourself. A vehicle with this telephone number on. We've tried to send some correspondence through the address for the company. The company, correct?
What company?
Jumbo Freight.
Sorry, I think you have the wrong number.
I don't have the wrong number because it's wrote on the back of the van.
1 minute.
Jumbo Freight. It doesn't ring a bell. Okay, I think you should go back and do some homework.
No, excuse me.
And so you hung up on him.
I did, yeah.
And you're walking down the street and cops are going, ha, 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 it's Daniel Obuchaki, ha, ha.
Exactly.
It's all real fun. It's real fun to be a bunch of thugs. It's real fun to push people around. It's real fun to be involved in killing women and men. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, they followed me on, like, buses, trains, everywhere I went. I mean, it was just, it got so much, so I was just trying to keep myself together. That's why I put this together, because, hey, if any event I'm not here, the book will still be here. That's how it is.
So you've already faced the fact that they may kill you. I think that lessens as you go more and more public.
Well, maybe, who knows, either things improve or things get worse, so you've got to take precautions and contingencies. But, hey, I'm not really afraid of anything. I'm moving forward. This is going to be out there thanks to the people like yourself spreading the word. Hopefully people can go online and order a copy. That helps. Get it to the
when your book comes out, we want to carry it, and we'll definitely have you back on, I'm sure even before then, and when the book comes out, and it's scheduled to come out in the next 3 months?
Yeah, precisely.
Steve Watson, any closing comments?
Well, yeah, I'd just say that, you know, everything that we're doing towards is towards getting a public inquiry going on this, because once, if that ever happened, then, you know, the whole thing would just fall apart. They want us to believe that it's just, you know, four people who just decided to bomb something one day. Well, it's not. It goes a lot deeper, and that's what we need to work towards.
Well, the key is this guy with the bandages on his head that are totally staged, and the other individual that Daniel saw giving everybody orders, who he's now gotten off television news. Steve, you ought to get a camera and get over there and interview Daniel, you know, to get this up with the clip. This is big. We got to keep working on this. When is a part two to the story going to come out, Steve?
It'll be tomorrow.
Well, I commend you. I commend both of you. And if you've got anything else you want to add, we can hold you over. If not, I will say goodbye for now.
Okay. Thanks for your hard work, and thanks.
No, thank you, Daniel. It's people like you that have courage and have their heads screwed on straight. You're extremely credible. It's on record you were on that bus. And everything you say mirrors and meshes with all the other information we have. Also, again, want to thank you, Steve. It's an honor to be associated with true men of courage like yourselves.
Thanks, Alex.